Our next case is A23-1363 in the matter of the welfare of DMB Child. As all parties are aware, the counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant appellate public defender, and I represent DMB, the appellant in this matter. There are six issues before this court today, all requiring reversal of DMB's adjudication or, at the very least, aspects of his sentence. These are all important issues that deserve this court's careful attention, but for the sake of time, I'm going to focus today on the trial issues. When the juvenile court found DMB guilty of second-degree criminal sexual conduct, she did so based, in part, on evidence outside the record and evidence that should not have been allowed in. These errors, whether considered together or separately, deprived DMB of a fair trial in front of a fact finder that was both impartial and appeared impartial. Because those errors prejudiced DMB, and because the failure to correct those errors would harm future defendants and the public reputation of the judiciary, this court must reverse and remand for a new trial. I'm going to start with the district court's reliance on the evidence outside the record. Throughout the proceedings, there are several instances of the juvenile court relying on facts outside the record. I'm going to focus on the two that I find the most damaging. The first is when the district court relied on her extra record, specialized knowledge of the requirements of foster care licensure. And the district court used that in two instances. That is nowhere in the record. No one testified to what it is required to be licensed as a foster care provider. And the district court used that in two ways. First, she used it to find that AW's statements to her father had sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness to be admitted under Rule 807. And second, she used it to find the same guarantees of trustworthiness for AW's statements made to investigator Carrie Walton, simply because AW's father was present. This was error. Shortly get to the role in the 807 analysis, but these are facts outside the record, and that analysis was error. The second circumstance is when the juvenile court relied on, again, highly specialized, extra record, non-personal knowledge about the psychology of the impact of trauma on memory. Despite the juvenile court's description or characterization of that knowledge, it is not common knowledge. And standing before this court today, I can't even tell you if it's true. The little bit of research I was able to do certainly presents a more complicated picture. But this is the kind of evidence that parties bring in expert witnesses to explain to juries. Had the prosecutor gotten up and had this been a jury trial and the prosecutor argued to the jury that it's common knowledge that victims of trauma experience memory in this way, that would be prosecutorial misconduct. It's not based on facts in the record. And the district court cannot go further than that in making this essential credibility determination. And that brings us to State v. Lopez. The law on judicial bias is complex, absolutely. But State v. Lopez really lays out the framework that this court should use in this case because it is the most factually similar of the major precedential judicial bias cases. And that's because the court in Lopez did not do an affirmative investigation. There were no affirmative acts. The court relied on a much less controversial finding, which is that April 2020 was the beginning of the pandemic and most places were closed. That is arguably general knowledge. And yet, the Minnesota Supreme Court found that it was, at the very least, clearly erroneous because it was not in the record. And while the Minnesota Supreme Court stopped just short of saying that it was perceived emergent bias, it assumes so throughout its opinion in Lopez, and in multiple instances said, this is the kind of conduct, looking at facts outside the record, that would cause the public to, that the public would find unfair.
Can I just interrupt for 1 second, just to, when I look at Lopez, and I think we end up in the same place, but Lopez says this is not an actual bias problem. Yep. Second, it said this is not a Dorsey problem, which is what they described as emergent bias, which is, and both of those are constitutional right cases, you know, whether you were given your right to an impartial judge, fact finder. And it says it's neither emergent bias nor actual. It says, however, perceived bias under the disqualification rule 211, right? Whether someone would reasonably question the impartiality. That's how I read it anyway. I'm not sure why we're introducing yet another category of perceived emergent. I mean, that's my point. Aren't we just under 211A1?
In some ways, I agree, but I think there are constitutional dimensions to, I think the 211A1 analysis is in many ways coextensive with the right to a fact finder that is both impartial and appears impartial, because that's what 211A says.
But you don't seem to agree with my reading of it, which is that the Supreme Court said we are not in Dorsey land and we're not in actual bias. And those are the constitutional things. We're in 211A land now. Why don't we just focus there rather than create this perceived emergent? It seems like we would now have for the first time an opinion that would, if we followed your analysis, that dealt with a perceived emergent bias.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think Lopez specifically says this is perceived emergent bias.
Where?
And throughout the opinion, I can find citations for you certainly on rebuttal.
No, okay.
But I think the way that works, I think it's a little complicated because it is these nesting standards. But the idea is that emergent bias is that something happens during a trial that transforms an impartial fact finder into a partial fact finder, and then the perceived bias is when the impartiality of a fact finder can be reasonably questioned. And so what Lopez does is kind of combines them in the ultimate analysis and says that something happened during this trial that could be perceived as transforming an impartial fact finder into a partial fact finder. And I will find those citations
okay.
for you.
Okay, cool.
When the court then conducted its analysis, you know, would you agree that the first factor is the risk of injustice to your client?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So in Lopez, the court sort of said the court relied on its general knowledge of the pandemic to discredit one piece of his testimony. Now, here it's not your client's testimony that's being undermined. You're saying it's being used to bolster AW's testimony. And they say it created little risk of injustice to Lopez at trial, the risk of injustice from judges relying on their knowledge regarding the COVID-19 pandemic is at best minimal for future defendants. I guess they're kind of going from the second analysis, but you know, one thing they said in Lopez is that there was sort of overwhelming evidence supporting Lopez's guilt. Now here, apart from all the hearsay, AW testified, and the court, without any other hearsay, could have convicted your client based solely on the victim's testimony. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement.
Okay. So, you know, how is that then not like Lopez, where the risk of injustice is not that big, even if, and I think this is more like Lopez than Dorsey, because neither one of these things involves sort of the, you know, do-it-yourself investigation.
I completely disagree,
so,
Your Honor.
Okay, so tell me why.
Because AW's credibility was the central fact at DMB's trial. And it was that very, the judge's reliance on her specialized knowledge of the psychology of victims of trauma was the dispositive factor in her credibility analysis. And if DMB is retried, could we reach the same result without that reliance on those extra record facts? Maybe. I don't know. But here, it's very clear that the judge relied on that knowledge to find AW credible, despite the many inconsistencies between her testimony, her brother's testimony, and her prior statements. But that's not the only finding that we're looking at. We're also looking at this idea of the specialized requirements of foster care licensure, and the
but
judge.
But I mean, if you look at I understand what you're saying. But if you look at conclusions of Law 6, it doesn't seem so much that the court, is relying on, its specialized knowledge as to victim trauma and, foster care parent licensing. While it's true that there are some inconsistencies between witness statements and even with agents, the facts related to the essential elements remain consistent. The child is completely credible in her consistent recounting, et cetera, et cetera. The inference is further bolstered by the later event in which Devin physically picked up a child, took her into her home. Where is all this, reliance on the foster care testimony and psychology of victims as essential to the court's ruling of finding your client guilty?
Well, Your Honor,
permeates it? Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, when we look at the district court's findings, the fact that she disregarded all of these inconsistencies is a result of this idea of the specialized knowledge about victim psychology. That, again, is unattributed. I cannot tell you if it's true or if it's not, because it's not in the record.
I just want to make sure I'm clear, because when I read the order following trial, it says Judge Conley reads, AW was credible, consistent, brothers credible. And so when you're talking about her extrajudicial knowledge or extra record knowledge, that's based on what she said during the trial, the transcripts. It's not in the order.
It is in the order, Your Honor. So in, I think it's page 4 of the order, when the district court is discussing AW's statement to Investigator Woltman that DMB had kissed her on a previous occasion.
Okay, I see that, the
yeah. Yep. So it does appear in two places here.
Appear anywhere else?
No. Just those. My understanding is it's just those two places where we're talking about her statements to her father and then the statement to Investigator Woltman.
And that's in paragraph 3 of the analysis.
I believe so. I can get that site specifically to that. Okay, you found it. Thank you. I also want to point out, I think that factor one of the Powell factors certainly weighs in favor of DMB, but there are two other factors here. And one of them is the risk to future defendants, and one is the risk to the harm of the reputation of the judiciary. And I think those also weigh in favor of reversal here. Because even if it was not a factor in this particular trial, when we have, I like to think about a defendant falsely accused waiting trial, trying to make a decision about whether to take a plea to a lesser offense. If he sees this trial, is he going to think, okay, I'm going to be vindicated? Like her, she can't keep her story straight. The judge is going to see that. All the evidence is going to come out. I feel confident going to trial. I don't think that defendant is going to feel confident, because in the last, if this case is affirmed, then juvenile courts who have the only fact-finding power over juvenile respondents accused of sexual misconduct can rely on facts that are not even developed at the record that they have no chance to counter. That's not fair.
Going to the specialized knowledge of the foster care parent, and you're right, in finding three or conclusion author, as a trained foster provider and someone who worked in the detention center for 8 years, does the record indicate he did work at the detention center for 8 years?
I believe we didn't challenge that part.
What I'm trying to say is, presumably, I think, and here the court tries to go to great pains to sort of your general knowledge versus, your do-it-yourself investigation. And it's the do-it-yourself stuff that always gets you into trouble, particularly if you say it on the record. Getting a foster care license in order to be a foster care parent, I think the average person does know that it's not like getting a driver's license where you just show up, pay your $30, and get your picture taken. So, I think that is kind of just the general knowledge that, there's some training there, and particularly a judge in juvenile court would know that as well. And I'm not so sure that gets you to the prejudice to your client that the court did not apply in Lopez but did find in other cases.
I see my time is up. My answer.
You can answer the question, Ms. Schultz. Thank you.
Thank you. Briefly lost track of my thoughts. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So absolutely is general knowledge that a foster care provider would have some kind of training, but she's talking about a very specific kind of training, and that seems almost equivalent to a corner house training, which is some kind of training aimed at getting accurate information from people reporting sexual abuse. And there's just no evidence of that in the record. I don't think that's common knowledge. Again, I don't know that it's true. So we ask this court to reverse.
Please go ahead, Judge Smith.
I'm trying to understand paragraph 3 that we're focused, because I think that now we're focusing on whether the court relied on it inappropriately in making a, material determination. Here the court said, as a trained foster provider and someone who worked at the detention center for 8 years, he fully appreciates the importance of handling such inquiries carefully. Okay, it doesn't refer to training or anything. He testified that the child told Waltman most of it, which is suggestive of consistency. In a broader context of that paragraph, which talks about the state didn't actually elicit this testimony, had they done so, I'm having trouble figuring out how the statement about father being a licensed or appreciating the importance of handling inquiries carefully by virtue of his background fits in here. I don't quite follow it.
I think I share a bit of Your Honor's confusion. I think the way I read this paragraph is that the judge was saying because he was present, he would have been kind of monitoring this interview to make sure that it was, not unnecessarily suggestive, that kind of thing. And so his presence with that training contributes to sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness to be admissible under 807.
That the child wouldn't have made it up because he was present? That it was not suggested to the child by Waltman? The reason I think it matters is it's like, this is a complicated paragraph, and I'm not sure it shows the direct error that impact that you're claiming, he talks about handling it carefully, and it says that, he testified that the child told Waltman most of it, et cetera. I'm having a hard time with figuring it out why it's so prejudicial.
Okay, yes. I mean, I understand that it is unclear. I think it's there for a reason. And the only thing I can make sense of is that it was his presence with that training that ensured that her statements made in that interview were trustworthy. I don't think I can't make any other sense of why it would be in that paragraph. And again, I want to point out that this is only prong one of the Powell analysis. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll see you on rebuttal.
Thank you, and you won't have time for rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Okay, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Sheilan Hamasor, and I represent the respondent in this case. So the issues in this case are in regards to what occurred at the trial and disposition level, and as it is the main contested issue here is whether the trial judge was impartial. Your Honors, this court should affirm the district court's ruling and deny the appellant's request for the following reasons: that one, the trial judge was an impartial fact finder and was not disqualified from presiding over the case, and DMB's rights were not deprived. The out-of-court statements that were admitted fell under multiple hearsay exceptions and within the rules of evidence. The district court did not abuse its discretion to adjudicate DMB as a delinquent. The district court had broad discretion when it ordered DMB to install a computer monitor provision on his device, and the order of a polygraph was authorized under Minnesota statute. So going into my first argument is that the trial judge was an impartial fact finder throughout the entirety of the trial. So the appellant raises four different instances where the trial judge was allegedly biased. Well, one was the requirements of the foster care licensure.
And do you agree that there's nothing in the record that indicates what the training or requirements are to be a foster care parent?
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look into the record here, AW's father had testified.
The foster parent.
Yes, he said that when they adopted their kids, they went through Min Prairie, Minnesota Prairie Alliance, and that they were licensed care foster parents through Minnesota Prairie Alliance, and they adopted through Minnesota Prairie Alliance. And the trial court judge used that testimony to bring a reasonable inference that AW's parents went through that training to get licensed. And it was essentially, it was general knowledge by the judge that that there has to be training going on because he was a trained foster care license, using that word trained. In addition to another argument that they're pointing out is the common knowledge of victims of sexual assault and how it impacts.
Can we pause? So let's stay on the training for a moment. I mean, as I read Lopez, even general knowledge, I mean, a court is not disqualified from having general knowledge.
Right.
When you look at Dorsey, you know, you're supposed to put aside your general knowledge and base it on the facts and the records and record. And under Lopez, there can be perceived partiality, I guess, if a district court doesn't put aside general knowledge. So in that case, a general knowledge was the pandemic. In this case, the general knowledge would be the training that a foster parent receives. What's the difference between those situations? Why isn't this a Lopez situation?
I think what this is that there was instances in like the transcript where like it was that he was trained through Min Prairie to become a licensed care to become a foster parent. So within that, there was testimony with that, the judge was able to bring a reasonable inference that he was trained. Like, he did indicate that he was trained.
I just want to make sure. So the testimony was the father was trained at Prairie what?
Or at Minnesota Prairie Alliance. So he said Min Prairie. Min Prairie is.
But he said he was trained there.
He said we were licensed as foster care parents through Min Prairie, and we adopted through Min Prairie.
Okay. You know, I mean, I'll give you my lack of general knowledge. I don't know what Min Prairie is, to save my life. So clearly, the judge is relying on some sort of. Either he knows that you get trained at Mid Prairie, or he knows, I think we all do, that, you know, there is some training and licensing procedures to be a foster care parent. So isn't your stronger argument that is just kind of general knowledge, and that, you know, it's not like, Well, I think I'll go to Mid-Prairie and start interviewing people and see what they do. I mean, that didn't happen, right?
No, but there was testimony from an individual that did work at Mid-Prairie, and she described what Mid-Prairie did and what they...
What is that person's name?
That is... just one moment, Your Honor. That was the Sarah Goodsell. She was one of the, I believe, the second-to-last witness on the stand.
And she's a social worker, or who is this Sarah Goodsell?
Yes, so she's a social worker at Mid-Prairie, and she's the one who did the coroner house interview with the child.
Getting back to the training, they could be trained that car seats are supposed to be buckled in, and kids are supposed to be in car seats. The training covers a really wide, could cover a lot of areas. We don't know that it specifically covers, I'm looking at paragraph 3 again, the importance of handling inquiries about sexual abuse carefully. We don't know that that was part of the training from the record. Is that right?
I believe so. So I think when you look at especially State v. Lopez, if the court does find that the judge ultimately, based on those that particular statement in the findings of fact that failed to set aside her personal knowledge in this case, I think that's where then we start looking at the Powell factors here as well. So under the Powell test, the court considers the risk of injustice to the parties in the particular case, the risk that denial of the relief will produce injustice in other cases, and the risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process. So essentially, like in Lopez, the Powell test was balanced by the legitimate objectives of providing parties with a fair trial and promoting confidence in the judicial system against the potential burdens placed on the judicial system and the parties by reopening a final judgment. So in in Lopez, that one thing that they did view was the issues of emergent bias is, and essentially that's where the trier of fact is not actually biased, but during the trial something happens that transforms it into a partial trier of fact. And in Lopez, too, they said that not all violations of that duty transform of an impartial trier of fact into a partial trier of fact. So turning into our case, the issues that appellant raises concern bias can be categorized by emergent bias if the court does find any bias here. And looking under that Powell test, the courts must first assess the risk of injustice of DMB. So like Lopez, the court's reliance on the foster care licensure training, if it was found that she did not set aside her personal knowledge, it's just a minimal risk of injustice because of the overwhelming evidence that supports DMB's guilt.
What is the overwhelming evidence?
It was just essentially the credible testimony throughout the court trial of AW and others who testified. So as essentially her statements that were not essentially
contradicted?
Contradicted.
But I mean, at the end of the day, it's okay, you've got her testimony, and then you've got the brother testifying that indeed the juvenile brought the victim into the house. Okay, so that's certainly corroboration, and that's independent. And there's no suggestion that, you know, the brother's testimony is somehow based on forensic specialized knowledge. But, I mean, that's it, right? The other is just statements that she made to the courthouse person and her father, and then the kind of the spontaneous statement she made to the brother during the Simpsons. But... you know, there's no other evidence, right? There's no DNA, there's no blood, there's no physical evidence. Would that be a fair statement, Ms. Hamasur?
Yes, that's correct. Okay. But
so isn't that different from Lopez, where there did seem to be all of that overwhelming evidence?
It is, but I think when you look at this case in hand, that her, like, with the corroborated testimony by the other witnesses, it did show that she was credible, and credibility is a big part of a case like this when there isn't any physical evidence such as DNA. However, she was able to testify to the essential elements of criminal sexual conduct that DMB was charged with. And most of the testimony that was inconsistent was small little details like the time of day, the time of the day, and just what type of games were played, but that wasn't relevant at issue. What was relevant was the essential facts of the elements of the crime. And looking at her statements when she went through the coroner house, those were consistent as well. In addition to with her brother's testimony as well, he had testified to the facts that he had seen her at that cornfield with DMB. So with all that testimony here, it shows that she was consistent. She was credible as she was consistently testifying to that main essential elements of that crime. So looking at that first factor here, then I believe that it is similar to Lopez here, just because there was that overwhelming evidence that supported DMB's guilt due to the credible testimony. Another thing, too, is a second thing that courts look at is what the risk of injustice is to other defendants. So in Lopez, the court held that it was unlikely that a finder of fact will find itself in a situation similar to the facts of the events that occurred at the very beginning of the pandemic, and the risk of injustice from judges relying on their knowledge regarding the pandemic is minimal for future defendants. I think...
Right, but that, I mean, as I read that, it was like, well, COVID's over, so this probably... Mm-hmm. I think Ms. Schultz's argument is, you know, for judges in juvenile court, if they start applying their specialized knowledge of, you know, foster care licenses or, you know, the trauma of sexual victims without being any expert testimony, then, you know, they are putting their hand or finger on the scale. So how is that not enough to show there might be just injustice in other cases?
I think the way that I see this is that this specific case, it has very specific facts, which included that foster care licensure. And I think that based off of, like, the very specific facts of this case, it is similar to Lopez in a way, because it's a little bit... I don't think the court would find itself in a similar situation again of parents testifying that they are licensed care, or they are licensed as foster parents.
Well, I mean, they certainly won't if we reverse. I mean, they'll get that message pretty quickly, don't you think?
Yes, but...
Now, what about the sort of integrity of the judicial process in general?
How can you explain a little?
The third factor.
Oh, yes. Okay, so in Lopez here, that the judge's general knowledge of the pandemic was the only one part of the judge's assessment of the defendant's credibility, and that the judge made an independent finding of fact that is decisive on the issue of premeditation. I think similarly in our case, that is what happened. The judge assessed what the witness's statements were, and even AW's statements, and the facts related to the essential elements of the crime, and those testimonies remaining consistent, which goes towards AW's credibility. The court did find AW to be credible as well, too. Therefore, I think it will not impact the public confidence in the judicial system. I think, essentially, it kind of goes into that first factor where that, or I apologize, not the first factor. I think it just goes into... essentially that this wasn't the only essential thing what the judge found was guilty of DMB. There was other instances as well where the judge did find DMB guilty, and it's not essentially just the main, solely, like, it's not that specific issue of whether or not that the father was a foster care licensure. It wasn't whether or not the victim had trauma. So I think that here, the third factor is similar to our case as well. And I don't think that will impact the public confidence in the judicial system. So based on that Powell analysis, I believe a reversal is unwarranted. I do see my time is running out here, 26 seconds, so...
Might as well quit while you're ahead.
I think just essentially based on the arguments I presented today and the arguments based on my brief, we just respectfully ask this court to affirm the district court's ruling and deny the appellant's request.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hemister.
Thank you.
Ms. Schultz, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to start out by talking about the differences between this case and Lopez. And while it does provide the framework, it is factually completely different. And especially, I think, when it comes to the Powell factors. So there is, you know, the first, we've talked a lot about the first factor, but I do just want to reemphasize that this case was about credibility, and one of these findings went directly to the heart of credibility. And one of the other extra record findings impacted the evidence that that came in. And some of this evidence is what we're talking about as corroborating. But the second and third Powell factors, I think, also really weigh in favor of DMB. In Lopez, the reason that the Supreme Court found that it was not prejudicial and that it didn't require reversal is that they were talking about the element of premeditation. And the district court discredited the defendant's testimony that he had a gun because he was going to a shooting range on the basis of it was the early pandemic, most places were closed, probably wasn't a shooting range. But there was evidence, and I think the defendant testified, that he loaded the shotgun when he got to the victim's house. And that piece of evidence was dispositive of premeditation, apart from the clearly erroneous finding. And we don't have anything like that.
Let me ask this, because, again, going back to paragraph 3, which is the only place where the trained foster parent thing comes in, it begins with regard to the two proffered statements from Waltman's interview, and that's what this paragraph is talking about. What are those two proffered statements to help me understand it?
If I'm honest, I don't understand I'm not sure what the second one is. The first is that DMB had kissed her on a prior incident. And that, to me, is highly prejudicial. It's an additional statement. It's not part of, certainly it was not part of AW's testimony. It's potentially another instance of criminal sexual conduct. And that came in through her statements to Investigator Waltman. That's the only place that came in.
So Waltman testified to it, or the statement?
Waltman testified to AW's statement that DMB had kissed her on a prior incident. And that's the only place that incident came in.
I mean, because the whole sentence says, with regard to these proffered statements, the state did not actually elicit this testimony. Had they done so, blah, blah, blah. That's what I'm trying to figure out. What statements they are, did they come in? Or is this just another thing, even if they had, they would have been fine? That's what I'm trying to understand.
And how did they come in if the state didn't actually elicit them?
Yes, did they come in somewhere else? Thank you. Yes.
They did not come anywhere else. They came in through Investigator Waltman's testimony. I don't fully understand paragraph 3, but I don't think the lack of clarity should be held against DMB when those are the two statements. Well, I'm
what's
sorry.
The second
I don't. I honestly don't know what the second one is, and I apologize. But the one that I'm concerned about is this potentially additional instance of criminal sexual conduct of him kissing a child who's much younger than him, and that's highly prejudicial. So that certainly goes to the risk of injustice. We haven't even touched on all of the inconsistent and additional statements that came in through the district court's analysis of the residual exception to the rule against hearsay. But this is why these issues work together, that even if they don't individually require reversal, which of course it is our position that they independently require reversal on many different under many different rules and standards, but together they work together to create an undeniable prejudice to DMB. When we look at the evidence that was used to find him guilty of second-degree criminal sexual conduct, it was evidence that was not in the record and is not reviewable by this court, and it was evidence that should not have been in the record because it was inconsistent with sworn testimony and because it included statements that were additional to the sworn testimony. And those statements included additional instances of potentially criminal conduct. That's highly prejudicial. This is not, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic won't happen again. This is something else. Every day in Minnesota, victims of criminal sexual conduct and alleged victims testify in Minnesota courts. And if this court doesn't reverse, juvenile courts can rely on extra record knowledge to credit that testimony, despite many inconsistencies.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please go ahead, Judge Riley.
I think I'm looking at analysis paragraph 3 that we've been focusing on with regard to Deputy Waltman. Excuse me. I think that the substance of his testimony may have been summarized in paragraph 7 of the findings of fact, because that's where the father testifies, and then A.W. made the disclosure to go over to the top of page 3, contacted an investigator with Still County, didn't know that individual, and then invited the investigator. I think that must be the part of Waltman's. Do you think I'm reading that right?
I think so, Your Honor. I'm trying to process it quickly and on my feet here. But, I mean, I think that's right. I think the reason that the specialized knowledge was relevant here is because he was present during that interview and presumably, I guess, monitoring it for accuracy's sake. But, again, that is not in the record. Thank you, Your Honors. We ask that this court reverse DMB's adjudication.
Thank you very much. Ms. Schultz, thank you, Ms. Hamas. Our decision will be issued within the statutory time frame. It's very nice to see you again, Ms. Schultz.